leave of the co-chairs because I'm only assigned to one subcommittee. I thought I would just sit in here, monitor. I'm ex officio member Keith Kerber from the RCA.
Officio member Aaron Whitney from Department of Energy, Arc's Energy Office.
Johnson,
I am. Yeah, point. Carl Hahnemann.
Great. And do we have anyone else joining us online through Teams?
Just make sure you're being content. So.
Oh, great. Thank you, John. Well, so for today's meeting, we have so the high-level agenda is we're going to first start with Gwen Holden is going to present on Iceland transmission and so lessons that we can learn from the, how they've upgraded their transmission system over time. And so we'll first hear from Gwen, and that and there'll be open Q&A opportunities as well. That'll be roughly around 30, maybe 40 minutes of the agenda. And then we'll switch back over to, during our last subcommittee meeting, we went through some framing for the subcommittee, talking about what our mission and our scope is and working on what's in scope and out of scope to again frame that up. So I'd like to, we'll revisit those slides to finish out the scope discussion, and then we'll move into discussing what our information needs are. And that will be, and the information needs are really driving towards, Tony and I were discussing earlier, you know, what will we need to meet our objectives and deliverables? And so let's get those information needs identified early so that we have time to gather that information and meet our timeline. And so that is the outline for today's agenda. And finally, we'll close with just hearing from the subcommittee members. I'd like to hear if there are any special topics or future agenda items for future meetings that folks are interested in. I'd like to gather those requests during this meeting. So thank you very much. We'll start with Gwen Holden.
Thank you, Ken. I appreciate the opportunity to present on the Icelandic energy market. And the reason why I think that this is kind of a useful conversation is that Alaska is such a, the rail belt grid is such so unique when it comes to when we look at transmission grids and infrastructure in the rest of the country, where you've got much larger and interconnected systems. And we have a lot more vulnerabilities. It's a very tiny grid. It's a fully functioning transmission system. And when you have, look at the rail belt, but it's on a really miniature scale. And so we don't have a lot of good analogies in the U.S., like probably the closest, and I think that that a lot of the rail belt utilities have looked at is the ERCOT model, which is also kind of a single state system in Texas. But that one is actually, it's more than two orders of magnitude bigger than the rail belt grid. So even there, it's not like a really perfect analogy. Iceland, on the other hand, it shares a lot of similarities to Alaska. And if you can just go ahead to my next slide here, I think I have a couple examples of how they kind of compare. Iceland is pretty similar in population. They have what I call the ring grid. That's not actually what they call it, but they just call it their transmission grid or their Landsnet grid. I think of it as being the ring grid because it, unlike the rail belt that is sort of like laid out in a linear fashion, they actually have a circular grid that kind of circles the island. Most of the population here lives within 50 miles of the coast. There's not that much population inland. And so that's kind of the way that they're structured. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about comparing and contrasting Iceland and the rail belt because there's some really interesting analogies and lessons learned for us, in particular with regard of the ownership and management of their transmission grid and how that's evolved over time and how that's enabled them to add incrementally higher proportion of renewables and then how that actually impacts some of their pricing structure. So that's kind of what I thought I'd share today. Next slide, please. All right, perfect. Okay, so again, so Alaska as a whole has, you know, whatever, a little bit over 750,000 residents. And when you're looking at the rail belt specifically and the population that that serves, it's like closer to about 500,000. That's still more than what we're looking at for Iceland. When you're looking at the size, you know, a lot of people say, oh, Iceland isn't nearly as big as Alaska, and that's true. But again, once you're looking at the area that's served by the ring grid, it's actually fairly similar to the rail belt grid. So I just kind of put that map on here. The two biggest cities in Iceland, I really think of this as being analogous to like Anchorage and Fairbanks, is Reykjavik and Akureyri in the north, and it takes about 6 hours or so to drive between those two cities. So like again, it's sort of similar in size, and so there's some real similarities and opportunities for lessons learned. So next slide, please. So when you look at install capacity, they're not that dissimilar. Iceland does have a higher degree of install capacity. You'll notice that for Iceland, they do have a fair amount of recip engines, which people don't really think about for a place that's producing mostly renewables. But again, this is mostly backup power. So they have a lot of grid vulnerabilities. They have a lot of regular outages in some of their remote areas. And so there's a lot of backup diesel generation in Iceland that people maybe don't think about that often. But it's really important because they've got these long stretches with like kind of single contingency, you know, point of failure. And so they need to have backup generation. Next slide, please. So this is the net annual generation. So this is where things start to diverge a little bit between Alaska and the rail belt. And I really just want to this is the rail belt, not Alaska as a whole, but the rail belt versus the Iceland ring grid, you can see that the amount of power that they generate on an annual basis is about 5 times more, despite the fact that they're meeting a much smaller population. So next slide, please. So this is when you actually break that out to per capita, that discrepancy, that disparity becomes even bigger, right? So they generate about 5-6 times more per capita than we do in Alaska on the rail belt. And they're actually one of the most energy intensive places in the world. And so this is something that I think is pretty interesting. And part of the reason why I really spent a lot of time thinking about Iceland, so just to provide a little context, sorry, to step back, I'm very familiar with Iceland because I actually lived there for a period of time as an Arctic Fulbright scholar and spent a lot of time researching the Icelandic energy market, working with them on geothermal. And so this is why I have a lot of like fairly significant knowledge about the Iceland market. We also have at ASAP a researcher that is based in Iceland, and so he's actually helped me compile a lot of this data in the charts, especially related to the energy market. So I should just kind of mention that. Next slide, please. So when you look at, the rail belt is kind of that pink chart, and I showed that in the previous presentation earlier today. And then you can kind of look at Iceland's trend historically, and you can kind of see that actually our generation or our energy production kind of tracks pretty closely until like about the mid-90s or mid-80s, somewhere in that period of time there. And then they diverge pretty significantly from us. And so I want to kind of tell a little bit about that story and why that is, you know, why we kind of got stuck there in the mid-90s. And I don't mean that in a bad way. They just took a different tack when it came to their energy future. And a lot of that did have to do with the grid generation and the interplay with C&I, like basically commercial and industrial load. So next slide, please. And the commercial industrial loads is a big piece of that. Iceland has a fairly long history working with the aluminum smelting industry, which is a really energy intensive process. The first smelter was constructed in Iceland, you know, very small scale, like in the late 60s. And so they kind of had some knowledge of that industry. Iceland was the poorest country in Europe at the end of World War II. And they relied a lot on imports of fossil fuels, mostly coal from Europe, and there was a lot of break in supply. And so they made a really concerted decision to switch over to all local generation for renewables several decades ago. But part of it was that they didn't have a lot of money, right? They were a pretty poor country. They did benefit a lot from Marshall Fund aid. And as that was sort of transitioning or ending, they realized that they needed a way to like have an industrial base in Iceland that could help support the local economy and provide economies of scale regarding, you know, energy production. And so they made a real effort to attract the aluminum smelting industry in a bigger way to Iceland and did so over time. So there's a real chicken and egg issue there where they were both working on attracting large industrial-based load customers while they also at the same time needed to build out the generation to support those customers. And that's actually a pretty interesting story. Next slide, please. I guess I didn't realize that. Yeah. So anyway, I'll just the first power plant that they built, the Skugafelt one, they actually, it's very, many of the stories around Iceland are so similar to the rail belt, to Alaska. The Skugafelt hydro project was a 210-megawatt project that was built in, though I think it came online in late 69, I think, something like that. And that was specifically to start supporting these large aluminum smelters that they were starting to bring online. A little bit bigger, or kind of similar maybe to a Bradley Lake. And they also created a state, energy, company called Lernsbergen. That's their, national energy company to build these big hydro assets. And they ultimately also became a part owner of some of the transmission assets that were used to interconnect those. It's really similar to what we've used the Alaska Energy Authority to do in the state here. Now, most of the generation is still locally, municipally, and independent power producer owned in Iceland, but the Lernsbergen, the state energy company, was developed to build these really large projects that individual municipalities or power producers couldn't take on their own. Next slide, please. This is an example of Karnhooker Dam under construction. This is the largest hydro electric facility in Alaska. One thing I want to just comment on is I'm presenting the story of Iceland, not necessarily saying what does or doesn't make sense for Alaska to maybe consider as a model. But this particular power plant, which was designed very specifically to support the aluminum smelter industry in eastern Iceland and build a bigger industrial basin, the eastern side of the island where there was less activity happening previously, it was a fairly depressed area. This hydro plant is the largest of its kind in Europe, and it could actually power the entire rail belt grid, just to give a perception of the size. Next slide, please. So, yeah.
This is Erin Whitney from Department of Energy. Why is Iceland a good place geographically for aluminum smelting?
The only reason why it's a terrible location geographically for aluminum smelting. In fact, most of the bauxite ore that's being smelted is coming from Australia. So if you think about the shipping lines, associated with that, that's pretty crazy. The only reason is because they're able to offer these very cheap contracts, like 3-cent power, for the aluminum smelting industry.
And so that's why they're drawn there.
That's why they were drawn there. It's purely like a long-term, low cost of power. Okay. And so you can see here.
One question from you.
Thank you. I appreciate that question, Erin, because it really reminds me of maybe just a little bit of context around this, because for this particular presentation, Iceland is probably close in latitude to Fairbanks or at least north of Anchorage, similarly placed on the globe. We talk about 10-cent power. We talk about things like economic development, and here's an example of a place that went all in,
right,
so to speak, which I think is a similar theme to what, why we're here. What does the future look like and how do we get there? And so I think this was a great example. I'm talking to Gwen, thought it would be great to bring it here. It also, I think, represents just, again, some context. We talk about energy security and we talk about, I mentioned low-cost energy and economic development. But think about, we've talked about institutional reform or potential structure changes to the rail belt that might, that's a sacred cow that should be, looked at. And in this particular case, the immediate need is we may achieve federal funding for transmission. Currently we have cooperative-owned transmission. We have mixed with state-owned transmission, state-owned generation. And if we receive federal funds, it's not going to go to any one utility. It's going to go to the state. And so part of this, in my mind, is to be looking at a potential example of a different transmission ownership structure that, again, facilitates all of the above, lower rates, economic development, et cetera. Thanks.
So just to continue, this is Glenn Holden again. So this kind of shows like part of, and I appreciate what Tony said, because like there are these like potential, I'm going a little bit sequentially through this historic part, and I'm going to get to the grid here in a second. But basically, what you see here is that about 3/4 of the power that's produced in Iceland is specifically used for this, for these energy intensive industries, and only about 17% is for sort of this public sector, which includes, you know, small Icelandic businesses and residential consumers. So next slide, please. So what I did here is I broke out that 17%, that's sort of the Icelandic public. So again, that's commercial and residential users that are small Icelandic businesses. And when you look at that, actually the rail belt and Iceland are pretty similar in terms of their energy intensity. So just again, to show that even though they're producing much more, they're consuming much more, they're a place that has an average cost of delivered power that's under 10 cents, despite the fact that they're a very small place. They're using about the same amount when it comes to like those local loads, basically. Next slide, please. So now I'm going to switch over and talk a little bit about the grid, because this is another place where there's a high degree of like similarities in terms of the story. Tony, you can tell me if this sounds like a pretty similar narrative. In the 1970s, there was a lot of local generation that was municipalities or independent farmers that were producing hydro from their farms and things like that. There was a little bit of this like patchwork of a grid. And if you could go to the next slide, please, that was sort of built up around 4 independent, not connected service areas, okay? So there was like local, you know, kind of a local grid in these areas, but this kind of follows a little bit where the population centers were, and these 4 grids were not interconnected with one another, these load centers. So when Iceland decided strategically, and part of this was also precipitated by the oil crisis of the 1970s, again, these price shocks that they were experiencing, they decided we're going to switch over to 100% renewables. But in order to do this, the first step is to firm up our grid. This is the very first investment that we have to make in order to move forward with like this larger macro strategy around scaling, reducing the cost of power, adding additional generation, things like that. So if you can switch to the next slide, please. So they interconnected these 4 regions, and this is what was called the ring grid. And at that time, those were additional new transmission assets that were also state-owned. So they were owned by the same national power company called Landsbergen. And so those are the same ones that built the big hydro projects. So again, this is very, very similar to like AEA owning, you know, hydro and transmission assets that are being, new transmission assets that are being built out. So go ahead, next slide. I don't remember what I was going to talk about here. Let's go to the next slide. I already showed this one in the script. So basically, that was all good. They were happy. Yeah.
Sorry, quick question. Do you know what the distance is to that transmission? Like what the mileage is?
About 2,000 miles.
Okay.
In total. That's what they have told me.
Of the state-owned transmission line.
Today is 2,000 miles. Thank you for asking that question, John. I have a few questions around the total linear length of the transmission network versus like regional grids and distribution networks. I have a few additional questions that I would like to ask them, but they have given me the number of 2,000 miles, and they've actually broken out in terms of the size of those different transmission linkages. So I can provide that. I have a white paper that this presentation is centered on that I can share with the committee. It's not quite ready for prime time, but I decided to focus on the presentation first. So they were happy with it. So basically where we are right now is exactly where I see Alaska and a rail belt being today, right? So there was a state entity that owned some of the transmission, some of the generation, and then municipalities and kind of local a whole mix, smorgasbord of other stuff, right? They were fine with that. They weren't going to do anything different. They were fine to stop there. But there's another factor that came into play, and that's that Iceland is not part of the European Union, but they are part of this European Free Trade Association that has a direct connection with the European Union. And part of the deal is that they're part of the European Economic Zone, so they get to benefit from all of the sort of benefits of being part of the EU. But in exchange, they have to adopt regulations that the EU sets in place around, like, certain sectors. And one of those is electricity. And so to remain part of this European Economic Zone, they had to unbundle and basically deregulate their electricity sector. They didn't really want to do it, but they didn't really have a choice. That was kind of a requirement of being part of the European Economic Zone. And so that's also true for Norway. I have done a lot of research on Norway as sort of like a corollary to Iceland because they did some things quite differently. Norway's a bigger country. And so, they did this disaggregation slightly differently in Norway and in Iceland. It actually has some repercussions for Norway today in terms of their price structure and their market that I'm not going to go into today, but it's actually pretty interesting as well. Okay, next slide. So basically what this meant is that they created a new entity, which is basically their TSO, their transmission system operator, is called Landsnet. So it was created as a state-owned entity specifically to manage, hold, and operate the transmission assets. And so that was established. And over time, they have migrated ownership of the transmission assets to Landsnet over time. That's taken a while because there was some complexities in terms of how it was bundled with other assets in terms of their bonds and basically financing packages. And so it couldn't just be done overnight. It was a lot more complicated than that. So it took them over a decade to kind of untangle those. And actually this year, they're going to kind of complete that transfer with the last little bit, which is sort of like a regional municipally owned transmission section. But until then, what they did is they basically leased those portions of the transmission assets to Landsnet and kind of pledged their use to that state, to that broader pool, and so to that TSO, and then ultimately like kind of actually made sort of that legal severance and then added it to. So the transmission network now is entirely owned and managed by the state corporation, Landsnet. All of the generation is still what it used to be. So it's kind of a patchwork of municipally owned, privately owned, and some state-owned for the larger assets. So next slide, please. Yeah, go ahead, Curtis.
Do they have their version of the RCA?
Yeah, they absolutely do. So there are some slight differences there. So they have their organization, Orkustofnum, is essentially the Alaska Energy Authority and the RCA merged together. So they have a single kind of state energy office. Yeah. So that's the way they do it there. And so that actually one of my really dear friends who was with me at Reykjavik University is now their head of their Department of Energy, this Orkustofnum. And so she's somebody that I talk to on a pretty regular basis about some of these things.
For the record, Keith Kerber. So they basically merged their state energy office and their RCA together.
Yes, they didn't merge them. They've always been connected, interconnected.
Okay, they started that way.
And so this is what their TSO and the generation stations look like today. So it's really similar to Alaska, and there's a lot of distributed generation all over the grid. There's some weak areas of the grid. They've had some real issues in terms of losing sections from time to time that they're dealing with. So there's a lot of similarities in terms of like trying to beef up the transmission system now to make sure that they're removing as many of these vulnerabilities as they can. Go ahead, Jen.
Gwen, this is Jen Miller. When they merged all the transmission assets under the TSO, did they realize additional benefits on as far as their cost structure or what they were able to access as far as federal, what we consider federal funds or...
Thank
what
you.
Were the benefits of that?
Thank you for asking that. So first of all, the cool thing about Iceland is there is no federal funds, right? Like they are it, right? And so they don't have like this other pool of resources that they can draw from. But that's actually the interesting story about Iceland is that they kind of went into this kind of kicking and screaming. They really didn't want to change their structure, but they are super glad that they did. It's created like a huge amount of additional ancillary benefits for them in terms of like streamlining the way the transmission system is operated and what it means for consumers. So Iceland's doing things, I'm focusing on the Iceland story. Not everything from Iceland is directly transferable or what I suggest would be exactly like cookie cutter how we would do it here. But basically what they're doing is that they just have a a set and established wheeling cost for electric power. And so you can be in Akureyri in the north, and you can decide that you want to buy power from a utility in somewhere else. And then you can pay for that basic cost of energy, which is like 4 cents a kilowatt hour or something like that. And then you pay a wheeling fee. Or you buy from your local utility and you have a smaller wheeling fee. For the outlying remote areas of the country, there's a subsidy. So everybody pays like a 0.29 cent subsidy for grid power. And then the places that are truly like remote and outlying that would otherwise pay a much higher rate, everyone's grid connected in Iceland with the exception of Grímsey Island. That's the only place that's not grid connected. They're on diesel. If you're in a really remote area, then you are subsidized, you know, 3 or 4 cents per kilowatt hour for electricity, and everyone else is kind of paying into that pool. So that's kind of the way they have it structured. It's pretty straightforward, and it's very clean. And I have some examples of bills that we can look at here. So next slide. So I just, this is a question that came up. I presented this previously to the Rail Belt Utilities, and actually MEA had a lot of really good questions around asset ownership. So one of the reasons, the other place where you have these small independent transmission grids is in Canada. Okay, so you'll see this around like the Yukon Energy Grid or the Snare-and-Telson Grid in the Northwest Territories. But the difference there is that they're owned by like a crown corporation or basically government-owned for generation and transmission. Iceland isn't like that. It's just much more like Alaska in that there's this patchwork of ownership, including about 5% independent power producers in Iceland. Next slide, please. So this kind of shows that transfer of assets that originally, and the way that it's worked in Norway, and I should say this is my understanding of how things have worked in Norway, is that essentially the entities that owned transmission assets when it was transferred to the TSO, what wound up happening is that they became shareholders in that transmission company. And in Norway, it's actually a for-profit TSO, okay? And so what happens there is that these munis, and this has been part of what their challenge with their price structure, they have some real issues in Norway right now because the TSO is a for-profit entity. The municipalities that are part owners of the TSO, that entity, they are reliant on that as a portion of their income for their municipal business. And so as the price has gone way up for southern Norway, that's interconnected with the rest of Europe, so they're paying like, they've been paying like 30 to 50 cents per kilowatt hour for electric power versus like 5 to 6 cents in northern Norway. The issue becomes that could you cut back on the transmission costs? People would like to see that, but the municipalities are dependent on that as an income stream, so it's super complicated. Iceland said we can't afford that. We cannot afford a for-profit. We just don't have enough people to accommodate that, so we're just doing it as a non-profit state-owned entity, and so they've like worked to transfer everything over to this lens that TSO that's state-owned, so like kind of owned by an AEA. That's their choice. That's not mandated by EU regulations. They've chosen to do that, and they've done it differently than most of Europe because they're small, because of their small market. Next slide. So this is kind of the way it looks when you get online to pay your bill. You get to pick which electric company you want to go and buy power from. Because it's so cheap, most people just don't really care. It's like 4 cents a kilowatt hour, right, for electric power. So they just pick whatever. But if you're pissed off at your local utility, you can buy it from somebody else if you want to. But you get to pick, and you can change that every month if you choose to. That's, I think, in Icelandic kroner and also in U.S. dollars. So next slide, I'm going to show bills. So these are specific bills, okay? So this is a bill for somebody that's in a really remote area. That's example, which example? One of them is, I can't even read this stuff, okay? the one that's cheaper, example two, is from the capital city in Reykjavik, and the example one is from that remote area in the Westfjords that doesn't have geothermal and is further away from power plants, basically, right? So this is kind of where you can see that that price of delivered power is the same for everybody. It's 4 cents, or for they're buying it from the same utility, I should say, right? There's a tax, right, a value-added tax on there. Then this wheeling cost, so it's quite different for the people that are further away from where the power plant is, right? $0.10 versus $0.045. Okay? But then there's this equalizing fee. That's like that subsidy for people that live further away in more remote areas. And then you can see that that person who lives in that more remote area benefits from a state subsidy, right? That's being created by all the other customers, right? And so then at the end of the day, like you can kind of see, it's between 11 and 13 cents. This is for just a residential consumer. So I'm going to go through a couple of commercial examples next. So,
and yeah, Gwen, just a comment on the equalizing fee. I think it's interesting how they structured it. In some ways, I like that better than how the PC is structured, because the PC feels very, legislative and kind of maybe politicized.
Yeah.
Whereas this is, you can see it's a line item on your bill. It's saying, hey, we're all in the same state.
We're all in the same state. Yeah.
We're all in it together. And anyways, it's just kind of a commentary.
So, and that, I really appreciate that. And that's kind of where, like, you know, that's why other places have often done like a postage stamp rate. So at least for a portion of electric power generation, that would be an alternative to like a PCE. And that's the kind of thing, honestly, like that might be worth looking into and exploring. You know, just because we've done things a certain way historically doesn't mean we can't look at different models in the future, especially if we're going to make big investments. And this is kind of like my argument. I've spent most of my career working in rural Alaska issues, and I deeply care about rural Alaska. But the rail belt, as we saw in the previous slide that showed that, you know, with the statistics, like, that's where most of the power is generated and consumed. So if you make investments there and you can distribute those statewide, that feels to me like the best approach. But this is just me saying this. Dan White?
Thank you. Gwen, can you comment on the heating discount that was on the previous bill?
So that's thank you for pointing that out. So Iceland is mostly heated with geothermal. They're super fortunate to have that. But the places that don't have access to geothermal heat with electric heating. And they get a reduced price that they're paying for the electric heating. They've done some really, there's so many interesting stories from Iceland. The way that they've incentivized municipalities, they're very much kind of free enterprise in terms of the way this has happened. Municipalities develop their own geothermal district heating systems. What the Iceland government has done is created this drilling fund that has enabled municipalities to drill for geothermal, and if their well doesn't work out, then it becomes a write-off from the state. It becomes a grant. If it works out and they find geothermal and they're able to develop that, then it becomes a loan, a low-interest loan from the state. And so that's the way they built out geothermal. If you're in a place where you have access to geothermal and you choose not to hook up, you're just like, I'm just going to stick with my electric heating, then they're not going to give you any kind of a reduced price for electricity for heating. But if you are living in an area like out in the country where there is no geothermal in those west fjords in particular, it's the older part of Iceland and there's less geothermal there, then they can use electric heating at a significantly discounted rate. That's the way they've got it structured. Next slide. I think we're going to go a couple. Next one. Yeah. So here, so this is just a small industrial consumer. So you can kind of see here, and actually we can't see because it's right behind that little box, but it should be like around 10 cents a kilowatt hour, 12 cents. Okay, so this is for a small industrial consumer. So now the next one we're going to go and just look at a larger industrial load, and then you can see this is where it starts to – so this would be like a small farm, and they grow about 60% of their food that they consume in Iceland, which is pretty cool. So there's tons of small farms. Next slide. So this is 7 cent power for a larger commercial user. So it's just basically like these different rate classes that they have. So it's just like any other utility. But so basically their rates are somewhere between 3 and 4 cents for the really large industrial loads to like that 13 cents for a residential user-ish, right? So, yeah.
Yeah, Tony, is up for the record. I think that it was called government subsidy, that 3.68 or whatever it is, and there's some, you know, comment about maybe our version of that is PCE. But I want to point out that it also seems clear to me that there's clearly a partnership with the state, and there's clearly a cost cause or cost payer aspect of this as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it hasn't, that traditional, rate making philosophy also plays a role in this. Just an observation.
Thanks, Tony. And so I want to be clear, like, I am not an expert on rate making and any of these details related to Alaska. So I'm kind of focusing on this Iceland example, but I feel like there are some opportunity for, you know, where things are similar and where you may have many more questions that we could then ask the Icelanders to do a little bit more research on. This has been a primary focus, is just understanding Icelandic energy issues that are transferable to Alaska. We're also working on things like district heating, things like that, food production. They get $2 for every $1 we get for their fish because they do so much higher add value-added processing. So, like, what are they doing there? There's a lot of these lessons. So that's what we're having the Icelanders work on in terms of, like, how they can transfer some of those lessons.
Are you going to have – this is Erin Whitney. Yeah. Will you have a summary slide highlighting where you think the parallels from Iceland would work well in the rail belt?
I would love to work with others on, like, maybe pulling some of this together because I'm a little bit hesitant to really draw too many conclusions because I don't feel like I am well-versed enough about the Alaskan, you know, market to draw all those parallels.
Tony, use it for the record. I think based on what I'm seeing, I'm starting to craft, you know, for the committee to consider a recommendation for analysis, you know, a recommendation that we, that defines, hey, here's what we want to look at as a result of this data.
Fantastic. Yeah. Because if I have something like that, we can do that work. If we have, like, specific questions, we can also bring the folks from Iceland onto a call like that work for LensNet. We have, like, direct access to the top leadership. Their director of their National Energy Authority, their version of Curtis, you know, would be happy to kind of share some of their observations with us if we would like that.
Well, I need to throw it out, and others may have something better, but we can, you know, try to gin that up maybe at the end. I'm holding it back, but I just want to give you that insight, and I want to see what else you have before I.
It also strikes me that there's crossover with, you know, some of the other committees, like the statutes and regulations and things like that. So my first reaction is, oh, you should give the same presentation this afternoon. But it is recorded, so thank you.
Sorry. Thank you, Glenn. First, we have a question from Curtis, and then
when you're talking about food security, is a lot of that hydroponics, or is it traditional growing operations when you talk about their food security and how much they're able to produce?
Yeah, so their food security and their energy security are super intertwined because they had these food challenges in terms of, like, imported food. So a large proportion of that is, like, greenhouses and things like that. But there's also a lot of, like, you know, small family farms and, you know, sheep and, you know, things like that too. But it's actually pretty interesting. They have an entire strategy around, you know, local food production, and it's amazing, like, honestly, what they've been able to do. But their low energy costs have been really, really key. So I've gone and spoke to a lot of the small family farms that have greenhouse operations. Actually, I think that, I don't know if Clay is not in this, but he and I went and visited a tomato farm together in Iceland several years ago. And we asked them about their energy pricing. So they're paying, like, 9 cents a kilowatt hour for electric power. That was what they were paying. And then they're getting, like, very inexpensive heat. And so they're able to grow these tomatoes, have a small restaurant there on site, and they produce tomatoes for the whole island. You know, it's pretty neat. So, yeah. But then low energy costs make a big difference there.
Thank you. And Commissioner Kerber?
Keith Kerber, yeah, for the record, just the thing that's so interesting is here we're sitting in a room, we have a gentleman who's both on, you know, just a participant in this, Andrew Jensen, who also has been working on food security. And, you know, that issue was brought up, like, under the Governor Parnell's administration, and I don't know that we made too much headway on that. But when you think about, you know, just something that happened in the last few years where the governor of Washington was going to shut down the Port of Tacoma or Seattle, and that would have put us in a serious bind. So the notion right up front in this briefing, I want to get a copy of this, Gwen. I need to socialize this with the people at the RCA, especially because the other comment that Erin made about the afternoon meeting of the Statutes and Regulations Committee is that, you know, it's interesting to just see a course of action. I really appreciate the fact that you're sensing maybe a rising enthusiasm to kind of say, hey, let's be careful, let's not get out ahead of our ski tests. But this whole idea of creating the generation necessary that could potentially help our food production,
yeah,
simultaneously, because
you know, there's been some articles about North Pole and their possibility of wanting to buy or get, create some sort of generation facility outside of the Golden Valley one in North Pole. And they even mentioned part of it would be that energy would be used to produce, you know, greenhouses to produce food like year-round. And I think that that's something that the average American, the average Alaskan doesn't know about but ought to.
Yeah. Thank you. And these are the things that I've been thinking about a lot. Like, you know, there's sort of that question, like, you know, Tony's been working on load projections, right, for the future for MEA. But those are sort of based around, like, current price structures, right? Like, if we, as Chancellor White said, you know, if we got to, like, let's say 10 cent power, how would that change? What would people do differently? And how does that become a little bit of a chicken and egg problem? And that's exactly what Iceland did. Their cost of power wasn't sub 10 cents several decades ago. They were able to do that by basically spreading those fixed costs across more kilowatt hour sales over time and really benefit the local population. Now, I just want to be also really careful here to say there's a lot of conversations in Iceland right now. For example, they are experiencing load growth, like, you know, just natural native load growth. And they may need to build additional generation to accommodate that. And there's a lot of Icelanders that say, if we just kick one of these smelters off the island, we'd have plenty of excess capacity. So we really need these guys anymore. You know, so there's like a lot of these, you know, there's a lot of conversations around this, actually, the way that they decided which projects to invest in. There's a ton of, I just don't want to minimize the complexity of some of these issues, right? But fundamentally what they did is that they played a chicken and egg game where they built up capacity. At the same time, they drove up load, and they have been able to experience really inexpensive power that all Icelanders are benefiting from today. And there's no reason really why Alaska couldn't strategically try to move in a similar direction if we chose to. Curtis and then Tony?
Yeah, Chris, quick question. What was the time period that they really did the kind of the explosive growth of the sizing?
It was in the 1970s and early 80s. Yeah.
Sounds like oil embargo time,
yeah,
or, exactly. Or right after.
That was exactly right.
Yeah.
We
were studying that and a gas line and, you know, probably a bunch of other things. But I think I'll just go back to the thought I was going to share, Curtis, because Curtis triggered something that, you know, fired off another multitude of synapses. But the price of energy, and I don't, you know, whether it be electric, gas, whatever it is, it's common. Utilities experience this quite a bit in that the price of energy drives, you know, sometimes we call it a dial back phenomenon. And you will have an opposite effect. So it isn't just going to be economic growth, but if all of a sudden, you know, we facilitate a path towards, say, 10 cent energy or half of what, say, the rail bell is paying right today, behaviors are going to change. I know I would be, well, my kids are grown and out of the house, but I would have been less concerned about them, you know, leaving lights on or windows open in the winter. And, you know, that's going to have, I mean, I've seen significant dial back from the gas utility perspective when fuel, you know, hit $5, which we'd all love to have today. But it was shocking how that monthly volume is driven by that, you know, human behavior connected to that thermometer or that thermostat is, you know, drives a lot.
So when I lived in Iceland, one of the things that was the hardest for me to get used to is how wasteful they are when it comes to energy. It was really difficult for me to get used to. You know, for them, they don't turn down a thermostat ever. The way they cool their house, they just open the windows when it's too warm, right? Like they're incredibly wasteful. Like the water that is coming out of their power plants that they're dumping into the ocean, the hot water, is higher in temperature than what we use at Pina Hot Springs to generate power, right? But they don't need to use it, right? So they just dump it into the ocean. Like they're really wasteful when it comes to energy,
yeah.
And they can't afford to be, right? I mean, they're thinking about that more in it now, right? Because geothermal isn't a totally unlimited resource. It has to be managed, right? And so they do see, you know, reservoir pressure declines and stuff like that. So they're trying to be a little bit more careful. But they don't need to be super conservative when it comes to energy, you know, compared to many other places.
Well, I would hope and believe that Alaskans would find a way to lead the way in conservation should we ever find ourselves in that kind of a good situation.
And so just as a super quick aside, and we were fortunate enough to have your latest commissioner, Donna Spindola, in our office on last Friday at the Alaska Center for Energy and Power. And one of the things that we chatted with him about is sort of this need for policy experimentation. And one thing that, for example, in Fairbanks that we're doing is we're installing electrothermal storage stoves in areas where there's poor air quality, and we're artificially pretending there's a 10-cent rate for electric power. So we're basically subsidizing those individual customers. We're asking them to use those electrothermal storage systems. We're basically saying we're metering them, and then we're paying the difference of like what their rate would be otherwise. And then next year we're going to do the same thing, but drop the rate to zero. So like, what's the natural uptake for like different kinds of technologies like that that would drive the rate up over time should we have cheap power? And so we're kind of doing that as like an artificial rate experimentation, but I'd love to see more kind of experimentation with technologies and rates like that as a potential outcome, you know, of our recommendation here. So I don't know if I have any other slides. So.
Thank you, Gwen. And we have another question from Chancellor White, and then I have a comment as well.
Thanks, Gwen. I was just reflecting on, I think it was Tony's, Dan White for the record, Tony's comment or somebody's earlier today about kind of focusing on less on kind of where we are and more on where we want to be. And I think about just strategic planning efforts of first establishing what we want and what behaviors we want, what power, what costs we want, and then, you know, where we are and acknowledging where we are, and then how do we get there? And is it focused on generation? Is it focused on transmission? And thinking about Wayne Gretzky's State Where the Puck's Going, you know, we're focusing right now on where Iceland transitioned in the 70s. Where's Iceland going? And can we kind of focus on where they're going as
thanks.
What we ought to be going as?
So this brings up a couple more like little points about Iceland. Number one, they don't have a bunch of legacy hydro, right? This hydro is like relatively recent, like that that Karnhooker Dam that I mentioned that was built in like 85 or something. That's a long time ago, but that's like Bradley era, right? We're not talking like 30s or something era hydro like the Pacific Northwest has, for example. Iceland's super fortunate in that their renewables are baseload power, right? And that's a huge advantage for them to have a hydro and geothermal versus like wind and solar, right? And so they're really, really fortunate in that regard in terms of like where they're going. You know, I think that they're going kind of the direction lots of things are going, which is sort of electrify everything, right? Like electric vehicles. They in Norway expect to be the first place in the world where they're transitioned to 100% electric vehicles, for example. So they're looking at like how can we continue to kind of drive up these loads and eat into these sectors that that currently they're still using fossil fuels for. That was actually like their primary energy consumption. There's still a fairly high proportion of oil that's being used there. That's almost all for transportation, for fishing, and they're looking at decarbonizing those streams now, right? I think this idea of like electrify everything and looking at how we can bring on board more electric loads in ways that benefit society. But I've changed my personal tune on some of these things, right? Like I've changed my thinking on it. But anyway, that's, I think, the direction that they're going for sure, is like more electrification of more loads so that they can continue to benefit from those native resources that they have available to them.
Well, when I just want to say thank you. I mean, I think the whole room feels, John, I'll come to you right after this. But this has been invigorating. I think when we first started this, in some ways the task felt daunting.
Mm-hmm.
And then now, based on this conversation, it feels like such a huge opportunity for our state to say, not only could we achieve cheap power, but could we create more jobs and bigger industry in our state? And commingling those two, killing two birds with one stone, I mean, just, and then even if we look at the North Slope and what that's done for our economy, but as the North Slope declines, we're looking for what's that next big industry. And, you know, as we look at our energy solution, we can also look at our economy solutions as well. So thank you so much. This has been very pleasant.
Thank you.
Very exciting. John Sims?
Yeah, thanks. So I love the presentation, and, you know, Gwen, you and I have chatted about Iceland before, so it is really exciting and a massive opportunity. One of the things that I think the entire task force would benefit from is almost sort of a rates 101 discussion on how existing utilities handle the rates. Because, Tony, correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm sorry to put you on the spot here, but let's say today you could switch over and you know, the state funded 100% renewable power to completely replace natural gas generation for you. Would you get to the 10-cent mark if that were the case? If all your power generation were replaced by renewable today?
This is Tony Izzo for the record. John, you know, assuming that it's, I mean, I think the simple answer is it would get us to somewhere between 12 and 13 cents, probably 12 cents. What that doesn't include is the operating and maintenance cost of, and depreciation, but, If it were free, if it just showed up and it were free, and you would eliminate the largest component of a consumer's bill, which is fuel, at almost 40%, and it would drop rates to, you know, to 12 cents.
Yeah, I think that's an important perspective because, you know, this is definitely a long-term plan, but I think in the short term there are, you know, that education 101, what's going on with rates today, is critical because we don't want to set false expectations about what these types of projects can do in the near term. So I just bring that to folks' attention. It's a massive challenge, but we still have a lot of education that needs to take place on how rates are structured and how things work today.
Follow up? Yeah, John, you know, the reality is that in discussions with the board, you know, we're preparing ourselves for what are very likely significant rate increases in the near future related to security of fuel supply. You know, we've been lucky at my utility where we've not had increases in healthcare in the last few years, but there were many years where it was 12% plus on an annual basis. We've been able to offset a lot of things. I think my point is that I think what's going to, if I'm a customer who just, all I care about is that my heat works and my lights come on, and I want to think about it, and I start to experience these 10, 15, 25%, you know, potential increases in the coming years, I'm going to feel a whole lot better if I believe and there's evidence that demonstrates that there's a plan to, you know, that this is temporary. You know, this is just a little bit of pain to get us to a better place, and I think that's the reality.
And if I may follow up, I think, yeah, Gwen, one of the lessons I guess I'm learning from the Iceland example is how do we, if we change the denominator,
yes, exactly,
and that customer base, that can, you know, there's our rates with our population and usage today, but what you're saying is a different way to look at the problem.
Yeah,
not only look at your generation types, your transmission costs and storage costs, but then also look at the denominator.
That's exactly right. So when I first heard the governor's charge to this task force of 10 cent power, you know, I think a lot of people said that's not achievable because of exactly what John and Tony just alluded to. Even if you got rid of all of the fuel costs, the fixed price of generation is still well above 10 cents. But if we're able to spread those fixed costs across more kilowatt hour sales, that's how you can get it down. As long as you're adding more generation, that's sub 10 cent power. And figuring out how to firm it up if you've got solar, it's a complicated thing and nobody has all the answers. But that's the only strategy that I can see that would work to get to 10 cent power personally.
Well, thank you very much, Gwen. So we have about 25 minutes left, and for the next part of the agenda, we'd like to bring up the slide pack that we reviewed during our last subcommittee meeting. And so could Lauren or Noelle bring that up on Teams? I emailed it this morning. And this is a less exciting conversation. It's a tough act to follow, but we want to but we do want to just kind of revisit where we left off on our scope discussion for our subcommittee. And we have some members that weren't able to attend the last meeting, so I think it's great to loop everybody in. and then have a focused conversation on our near-term information needs and requests. And something similar to what Tony brought up as far as folks that we might want to connect with in Iceland to get additional information.
Sounds good. And Lauren, if you wouldn't mind sharing, I'm not a presenter on this call, so I don't have on-screen sharing capabilities.
She's the presenter now, so.
And so, Lauren, are you able to share that slide deck?
I can fill some dead space with a recommendation that you save some time later. When we get to it, I think that there's an opportunity here based on all the things discussed to have some analysis done. And again, this is thinking out loud. You know, depending on the will of the group, we can, you know, clean this up and write it down. But I think about transmission as economic development highway, and if we're going to, as we've heard from the governor and the administration, very excited about the potential for economic development, changing the denominator, as Jen talked about, I think it would be critical to look at least the transmission ownership structure. What I really like about the Iceland model is that there can be different ownerships. It can be leasing, so you're not mandating a utility. I mean, in particular, my utility, we own so little of the transmission that's required to get from Homer to Fairbanks that it doesn't represent a concern. I mean, we can sell that. We can, you know, add book value. I'm not committing to that today, but notionally we could do that. For others, it might be more difficult than that because it represents more than 15% of their margins, and it affects that 85-15 rule, and it's going to take vote of membership, and it's a supermajority, and you need like 75, depending on the bylaws, 75% of the membership to vote, and you need 66% of those voting to say yes, and you're lucky to get 10% to show up at any kind of an annual meeting to vote. So it seems like there's an opportunity to take a look at this in an effort to also address the potential for additional transmission investment by the, whether it be by the state or through IRA or IIJA, into a regional transmission organization or transmission system, whatever you want to call it. And what I would, you know, really like to see is something that eliminates wheeling. Now, one possible way to do this would be investment from the state to eliminate the debt on the transmission, and create maybe a structure like the, you know, whether it be a BPMC or a, you know, there are structures in place today like the Intertie Management Committee. They're not for profit. It's a state-owned asset. The utilities continue to maintain and operate the facilities in their regional areas. So the transmission that's in Fairbanks would still be operated and maintained by the IBEW employees that are there. You don't create any kind of a shift in labor force. But it would, if you could uplift that wheeling or eliminate it, maybe it's a per kilowatt hour basis, maybe it's eliminated through the state investment by buying that debt or buying that transmission. It seems like that could facilitate, certainly make it a more equal playing field around any kind of generation that comes on, being able to move it anywhere in the system. I could buy excess power from Golden Valley if they have it, or Bradley could move, you know, power around when we need it. Not, you know, we get all the energy out of Bradley Lake. We just don't get it when it's the most efficient because of the constraint in the system. So that's my narrative. It's not perfect. I'm open to changes, thoughts, questions, and it seems to me there's an assignment in there somewhere for us to take a look at and compare it to, well, what is it today, to what is it that we want it to do, and what would it cost?
Okay. Thank you, Tony. And I see Johnson has his hand raised as well.
Just a quick question on that, Tony. Would you include generation as well in that group? Because it seems like often there's a battle amongst the robot utilities on who gets to generate power for which entity or for which point of population because of the denominator issue, right? The more you've got, the better that is for our utility. But could you eliminate that with the generation as well? Or what's your view on that?
Well, I think what you're talking about, John, is typically referred to as a G&T or generation and transmission entity. It would be hard for me to articulate with the amount of time we have left today the hurdles, and we probably want each utility to speak for themselves in terms of doing that. I think transmission would be a great first step. If you had a transmission system that was open and had the capacity, there were no security constraints, you really eliminate the economics would dictate what generation came on and in what priority. And it takes away the parochialism, John. So I think it addresses initially the issue that you raise. I frankly am agnostic because the commission has approved my ability to pay the long-term mortgage on the $300 million power plant debt that I have. I can recover that no matter what, even if the fuel drops to zero tomorrow because some new renewable. I'm agnostic. I'm not financially harmed by that. The COPA, though, which is 40% of the cost per kilowatt hour, I have every motivation, so does every utility, to take the cheapest one possible. So what this could facilitate would be a pure economic dispatch across the entire rail belt system.
Erin, if I may, this is Erin Whitney from the Arctic Energy Office. I love your enthusiasm, Tony. This is great. But I wonder, in the interest of the time that we have today, if we might simply, and I know we're getting out of order here, Jen, because you're trying to stick to an agenda here, but I wonder if we might say more broadly that we want to identify some of the components of, you know, the Iceland system that, you know, are attractive and flesh those out in some future meetings, like what does transmission look like? What would those parallels be for the rail belt? What would some generation parallels be for the rail belt? What might subsidies, pseudo PCE, I forget what it was called in the Iceland bill, what might that look like for the rail belt? Like, and have a more detailed analysis of some of these areas and how we might adapt those to our purposes. And I think that's exactly where some of these details can come in.
Yeah, I thank you for pulling me out of the midst of the trees and describing the forest from a distance. I agree completely, because I think that work will help guide us. And
hey.
Others, anybody?
Well, I guess what I'm toying with is I think right now, having just heard the presentation, our brains are all, the gears are turning, and I think this is kind of a ripe opportunity to get down. Maybe this is kind of skipping to what are our information needs or what are our future subcommittee discussion topics. And so I think because we have a lot of energy around this rather than revisiting the scope, I'd like to take this opportunity to gather those ideas. Tony and I can kind of go through those and organize them. And structure them so that, you know, we're working things in an efficient order. But if it works for you, Tony, as co-chair, if we open it up for either requests for information or ideas for future discussion topics for future meetings. And so we've got one is lessons from Iceland that can be applied to Alaska, and a subpart of that is looking at the Alaska transmission structure. Erin, if you have your hand raised.
Yeah, I wonder if we could actually break it up into some sub-areas, so, you know, a transmission discussion, a subsidy discussion, a generation discussion, or maybe those are successive topics in one meeting to sort of flesh out what the end goals might be and what the steps might be within our system to get there.
Okay, great. And maybe it'll be helpful, too, to just hear everyone's ideas and requests, and then we can kind of figure out what that structure is, but I like what you're saying. How about other ideas from the group or Carl?
Yeah, Carl Hahnemann. I just want to say that I did listen to the symposium discussion on Iceland and so was encouraged by that. And as co-chair of the Statute and Regulation Committee, I wanted to attend today's meeting here today specifically because I believe that this is one of the few maybe really actionable, transformative actions we could take as a group. And I'm heartened and will do everything I can to try to flesh out the details of what we could recommend to the state to integrate our transmission system as the first step. And so I think we discussion of the generation is also appropriate, and our PCE or the cost sharing mechanisms and recognizing our different communities is important. But I think we can get there on the transmission portion, and there's been some efforts in the state to consider that to date so far, but they've stalled, and we need to figure out how to break that stalemate and actually get this done. And I think Iceland's example of implementing over a period of time that recognized some costs and, these things that perhaps they take state investment, the state has the money, these are the kinds of things the state should be investing in if it will ultimately lead for a stronger economic base and lower costs for Alaska for the next 50 years. So that would be, prudent investment. So I'll roll up my sleeves to help in any way I can.
Great, we'd love to have you. another idea that I came up with, our discussion topic, is actually maybe a brainstorm on how could we increase the denominator and what, do we want to, and I don't realize that's kind of going to be another moonshot type discussion topic, but, something around manufacturing or getting into, raw minerals for batteries, and looking at that symbiotic relationship by attracting new industry and driving down energy costs. And so maybe a future topic is a brainstorm on how to increase our electricity demand such that it helps drive down the price. And John Sims, when you were speaking about, do we include generation, something else, in the transmission structure, I wonder about storage, and that's kind of something in the future, but should storage be a centrally controlled asset and kind of being that backbone? And I don't know what the right answer is, but it's a question on, if we're going to allow or have more generation types tying in, what facilitates that and how do you kind of remove the barriers? And so, could there be something around storage?
Actually, I think that's a very good topic, and I think the utilities can kind of unite with that because we with AEA and the utilities have been working not only looking at the Homer battery, how it's integrated with the South Central battery, looking at Fairbanks, because, and how we work that renewable piece into it, and also there's I'm going to say issues. There's some operational issues with Bradley that battery storage is important to have as a component of it. And AEA already has over $50 million set aside to 4 batteries on the rail belt. And so I think that's a great topic. And there's some stuff that's happening behind the scenes that I think is important we probably should get out in front of.
Okay, great.
Jen?
Yes.
Yeah, Keith Kerber for the record. I'm thinking about even the comment that came up in an exchange between you and Gwen a moment ago about the fact that their renewables in Iceland are baseload, because they're always on. The water's always on. The geothermal's always on. And the thing is that while I had to hop in and out of the AVEC class, which I'm really glad it's been recorded because, Glenn and I had a conversation, maybe we need a couple more AVECs to help the people in rural Alaska because that's an area where we've seen the non-base load, so to speak, wind and solar have some real victories, right? But I would like to at least throw out here because, Curtis, you made this comment a while back, and in terms of maybe a policy thing as opposed to a statute of regulations, we've already seen the state move pretty rapidly to, and I'm too bad Deputy Commissioner Pocon or Pomon is not here because DEC worked to help with the siting regulations for advanced nuclear. And the thing is, that's the stuff that could be the it's not a battery, but I ask when in a conversation, I kind of look at them like nuclear batteries, because if you can put it on the back of an 18-wheeler, it's probably not, it's nothing like Vogtle 1, 2, 3, and 4 in Georgia. So having this, what do we look at the mix end? And this goes to the notion of what Curtis had mentioned with, not, how do I say this? It's not sort of giving the Heisman to the RPS bill, but maybe an idea for a clean energy bill, because around the nation, nuclear has all of a sudden been called clean nuclear. And I'm even thinking with John's face peering out of the screen here, clean natural gas. I mean, it's funny how the conversations have changed as people have looked at what we need to actually make the transition. It's not a switch. We can't just flip a switch and boom, we're all on renewables. But the idea of getting ourselves more on that, which speaks to something the governor said a long time ago about Alaska's energy giant. How can we do that? And I also just throw this out here, and I'm sort of serious, not serious, but more serious than that is, hey, if ISIN wants to get rid of their aluminum smelters, let's build them in Alaska. That could help build up our load, right? If they want to give that up, I think we're closer geographically to Australia than Iceland. So anyway, other than Chinese subs in the Pacific, we could be okay.
No, thank you, Commissioner. And how about other ideas or information needs?
Carl Hahnemann. Just thinking long term for Alaska, and it's already been discussed, but I do think that well, in the short run, we can't unite all our utilities. We have to look at the fact that we really are a really small grid, and we respect the origins of each of these independent utilities because we were all independent communities. But if we're going to upgrade our transmission and no longer be independent, we can't have six people trying to be involved in deciding what's the next best optimum generation, so we don't overbuild generation, so we get economies of scale, which we don't have now. And so I think there's we have to not forget that goal of over time, or I think we want to be. So.
No, thank you, Karani. That's really important. It's kind of what's the order that you work that transition in? And how do you get the biggest wins first and over time? But yeah, don't lose sight of the final objective. Erin?
I would also just encourage you to, Gwen's last slide, which wasn't up for very long, there are a couple other points, and I would encourage you just to maybe mull over those. There was something about, you know, loan programs, and a few other things that might be lumped into a discussion as well. Because when I think of loan programs, you know, immediately my mind jumps to the DOE loan program office and what role that might have through the state. So I just encourage you to think about some of those other bullet points that were on that last slide that I can't remember right now.
Okay. Thank you, Erin. And another topic that Tony and I have talked a little bit about, but, you know, one of our remits as a subcommittee is, you know, the governor wants us to look at multiple scenarios for what the future could look like. And I think that's going to be very leveraging for us because, you know, one, it helps to have multiple paths because it'll likely be a mix or who knows, but having multiple paths to get there and kind of knowing what the pros and cons are of each of those options, it can inform, you know, inform how we move forward on any piece of it, whether it's generation, transmission, or storage. And so I think it will be helpful to, as a subcommittee during a future meeting, to sit down and talk about what are the, maybe, you know, whether it's generation types, when we say, you know, these are the cases we want to look at. Maybe there's a base case that assumes our current natural gas LNG mix or, you know, potential future LNG mix. Maybe there's a wind solar case, there's a nuclear case, and just kind of look at those types of scenarios, a hydro case, and weigh those pros and cons. And so I think that's a key, I think it'll be good for us to coalesce on what are some of these primary cases we want to look at, and then have Black and Veatch get kicked off on doing some data analysis and metrics for those. And so, I realize this probably feels a little bit chaotic. It's a bit of a brainstorm, but I think, you know, it's actually very helpful for Tony and I to hear these different ideas, and then I think we can structure the next meeting based on these information requests and kind of get a roadmap put together on what are these discussion topics and start to feed the information request to Black & Veatch. Carl?
So Carl Hahnemann here. And so may I add one scenario for your consideration, is that when we look at the next 20 years transition and energy security and potential costs, and when we also look at our scope, which I believe should include space heating and you know, the heat, I think that the Alaska LNG project needs to be in that mix. And short term, we may have to import LNG. But, you know, for the next 20 or 40 years, in terms of stability of supply, and I think the state should consider a significant investment and piece in that if necessary to partner with other sovereigns that will be necessary to get it done, you know. But I mean, I think that I know we maybe need to be a little more aggressive in our state's participation in order to put it over the line. But I think that needs to be on the table for discussion, because the ramifications and benefits of Alaska long term are outstanding.
Mm-hmm. So. Thank you, Carl. Okay, I think we have actually about 9 minutes left. If we could go to slide 6, we might have a little bit of time just to revisit our scope discussion for the subcommittee. And we got, let's see, if we can go up one, or back one slide. There it is. Thanks. And so I apologize for the small text, but this is where we left off during our last subcommittee. And actually, this could be helpful based on our recent discussion here, but this is where we landed on in scope, out of scope. You will see that we did add, I believe we added heat to the in scope analysis, because we did want to look at both the current, you know, current and future electricity demand and consider transitioning heat. But I'll just put this up and have the subcommittee members review that, and maybe based on this discussion, today's discussion, or any other comments, is there anything that we want to call out to in scope? And we did want to articulate, you know, what we are not looking at. And so please let me know if there's any additions or changes you'd like to see.
Trying to get my mic to work. Tony is up for the record. I think about I could split this into so many things. You know, where do we want to be in 100 years, 50 years, 20 years? What do I have to get through and triage, you know, between in the near term and while we're laying foundational, you know, footing for the future? And I'm thinking about the deadline in October for a report. I agree. I think he being in scope as it relates to generation, I mean, just remembering Gwen's presentation about geothermal, I think it has to be included in that regard. But are we, and I'll just say, I don't think we have the time to go there. I hope we're not talking about, it's up to the committee. If you are, I'll support it, but not in favor of, you know, we're looking at residential home heating conversions. I had some experience there, and it's a pretty large nut to crack.
So what I understood from the last subcommittee meeting is that when we look at future demand, we wanted to do some projections if there was a certain amount of conversion. And so not that we're necessarily analyzing how to get there or those costs, but just look at it from a demand side.
Right.
Look at our supply demand. That was my understanding.
Yeah. Jen, again, Tony, I completely agree. I think from an economic development perspective, you know, there's always the example of if you build it, they will come. Ken Costner, Field of Dreams. But that is so contrary to, you know, acceptable rate making principles, because you know that's where you have to partner with, whether it be public-private partnership or state partnership. I can't technically by today, unless, you know, again, this could be a statutes example. I don't think I would get very far, certainly under statute, certainly with the regulatory commission, and definitely with the membership or ratepayers. if I said, I'm going to arbitrarily add $10 a month to for X, I'm just going to get blown apart.
That's good context. And John, I think you were involved in the heat discussion, so I just wanted to check in with you and see if there's anything you want to add. And you had shared some, even some conversion costs for conversion, I believe, for homes from natural gas to electrified heat.
Yeah, this is John Sims, for the record. It all goes back to the denominator, right? If we want to drive electricity demand, what would the actual cost be to convert residents to electrical heat? And we did do a lot of work on that. We've talked to a number of electrical contractors out there in the market, and we have some numbers. We're happy that I think I already shared them, but welcome to walk into those and talk about that if the committee would like to see them.
Yes, Chancellor White?
Yeah, Dan, for the record. I mean, I brought up heat several times as well. Just, you know, in our own experience, we run a coal-fired power plant because we need heat. And if you would have to have pretty cheap rates in order to get us to heat 3 million square feet at the university with electricity. So as we think about, and particularly in Fairbanks, right, we have an air quality problem because of wood stoves. If we converted, if there were 10-cent power, those homes would all turn to electric heat. And I think that to Tony's comment earlier about how do you then manage that in our existing rail belt, I think is an important question. And you can, my comment, I guess you could put it in a scope or out of scope, but just thinking about Gwen's presentation and the ring grid, and if we're thinking about 10-cent power for the state, and we're thinking about how do we serve kind of the rural area, coastal areas, what do we mean by the rail belt anymore? And if we think about just the rail belt, are we confining ourselves to what we have today instead of thinking about a broader solution that solves a bigger problem that the state has or a bigger, takes advantage of a bigger opportunity? So I don't know, you can, I'm not on your committee.
Yes.
No, thank you.
With whatever bucket you want.
Go ahead, John.
If I could interject real quick, it's dangerous to assume, and this is based on personal experience and company experience, it's difficult to assume that at X amount of power, everyone's going to convert, because the big piece to think about is what the cost to convert is. So, for example, we just extended down to Homer, you know, 10 years ago, and we assumed because the cost of natural gas is 3 times cheaper than electricity and 5 times cheaper than propane, that a vast majority of the customers are going to convert. And what you find very quickly is, well, I just bought a brand new furnace that, you know, handles, you know, oil, and I just bought a brand new stove that's propane, so I'm not going to replace those until I've used them out, or I just flat out don't have $20,000 to go and convert. So I think a good assumption is that you're absolutely going to get any new build or any new construction is going to be on that electric power at 10 cents kilowatt hour, but the assumption on what and who is going to convert is a difficult task. And you can't assume a high percentage right off the get-go.
Tony?
Yeah, Tony is over the record. I just share anecdotally experience that I have being hired after the oil embargo in the gas business, where it was against the law to add a gas customer, and it was against the law to gas utility reinforced that you could not use gas for lighting, mostly outside, barbecue grills, things like that. It had to be for heat, hot water only. And the oil embargo lifted, and I was hired, and so were a lot of other people after that period of time. And we went, the differential was you had neighborhoods where homes paid an amount for heat, natural gas, and the next door neighbor came in during the embargo, and they paid 5 times as much for electric heat, which was easy for contractors to install. It's the cheapest thing to put in, especially in those days. Once that embargo was lifted and we could add customers, we added a minimum of 17,000 a year over a 12-year period. So that's over 200,000 meters that were added to a utility that had 250,000 meters. And my experience of living, you know, through that early in my career it supports exactly what John said. It does not happen. We don't have the HVAC resources to do wholesale home, you know, or small business replacements. It happens over a period of time, which is why I think it's so critical to, at least in looking forward, to Jen's point was, you know, we need to factor that in because it does happen over time should we get there. It just doesn't happen overnight. It took more than a decade.
Okay, thank you. I know where we are at time. I'm just going to abuse my power a little bit. okay, oh no, this is dangerous. Just a quick comment. We identified an in-scope item of utility structure, and maybe we'd retitle that to talk about ownership structure as it relates to the transmission, storage, and generation. Anyways, that's an idea. But just want to, again, thank you, Gwen, for the energizing this, example of Iceland and helping us dream a little bigger. And Tony and I will take all the discussion as far as, you know, topics that the group sees that are, you know, necessary for us to do our work. And we'll work on structuring and organizing those so that we have, you know, and we'll give you guys a heads up on what the topics will be and take feedback as well. But just want to say thank you to everyone, and it's been a great discussion.
Thanks, everyone. If I may, this is Noelle from Michael Baker, and I just wanted to close out reminding everyone that the end-of-the-day report coordination will just involve talking about the findings of this meeting, and it sounds like we're all squared away. So thanks for making my job as a facilitator super easy.
Thank you. And sorry, I do want to check in with Tony. Anything else that you want to add as we close?
No, thank you. And just thanks to Glenn Holtman, and thank you, Jen. You run a great meeting.